What next for Ukraine? Today, February 19th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. Another day of violent anti-government protests in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. We take you to the heart of the protests, Independence Square.
One man said that he was there because he has two children and his wife is pregnant. That's why he came down there, because he was afraid for their future. Another person said he was down there and he was going to stay till the very end, but he was very much afraid of dying.
Plus, how events at home are affecting Ukrainian athletes competing in Sochi.
The Ukrainian athletes were saying that people were coming up and expressing concern, expressing worry, expressing solidarity again with the protesters and really just with the Ukrainian people and the uncertainty that they face right now.
Plus, a New York chef who learned all about the restaurant business through sea urchins.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. If Ukraine's Olympic Committee had its way, its athletes would be wearing black armbands in Sochi today. We'll talk about Sochi and the Ukrainian athletes a bit later in the show, but we want to start with what's behind their request to wear those armbands. And for that, we go to Ukraine's capital, Kiev, where the images from last night's confrontation between police and protesters are startling. There are pictures of the protest square on fire, of people on fire. At least 25 were killed, including protesters and police. And the violence continued today. Earlier, I spoke with the BBC's David Stern. He'd been in the square all day. Give us a visual. What kind of things were you seeing all day? Is it sort of protesters attacking, police responding? Literally, what's been going on?
Well, there's all sorts of things going on down there. Of course, there's the front line that's on one side of the square. That's where the police and the protesters are facing off against each other. There's sort of a no man's land between them, and the protesters will throw Molotov cocktails, bricks. The police respond with stun grenades and with rubber bullets. Then in the square, the police occupy sort of a corner of the square, but the main part of the square is still very much the protest camp. The protesters have been there for the last 3 months. They've set up a tent camp. They have these barricades, very extensive system of barricades built around it, and they are carrying on with their demonstration. They have music performers, they have speakers, and then further on you have the soup kitchens. They have set up these mobile sort of military kitchens that dole out different, I don't know, borscht, if you know, the beet soup, different things to eat, as well as hot tea and hot coffee to the demonstrators. I was just down there, and there were many thousands, and it seemed that there were even more pouring in as I was walking around.
And of course, the protests themselves have been going on, as you mentioned, for several months since President Yanukovych turned back the deal with the EU and tilted back toward Russia. But of course, it's turned very violent in the past 24 hours. Can you give us a sense of who these protesters are? Perhaps you could tell us about some of the protesters you actually talked to today.
Well, there's all types. This is a large protest movement. We've seen hundreds of thousands on the streets before now in Kiev and also in other cities, mostly in the west, in the center of the country. So you get all types, old and young, professionals and workers. It's a real array. Of course, the hardcore group, I guess you could say, or the core group of protesters who are occupying the square, they're a different sort. It takes a special person to spend weeks on end, and it's warmer now, but it was sub-zero temperatures at one point. Some of these people are from the far right. Some of them are from other organizations, but they have a more, I guess you could say, a more aggressive bent, although they do seem to have quite a bit of support among the general group. We spoke to some people. There were a number of young people. They were said that they came down there. One man said that he was there because he has two children and his wife is pregnant. That's why he came down there, because he was afraid for their future. Another person said he was down there, and he was going to stay till the very end, but he was very much afraid of dying. So you see all types down there, and all types seem to be arriving.
The Russian press is partly describing Ukraine as a sort of already in a kind of civil war. Do you have that feeling at all down in the square, or is that not a correct characterization?
No, that's not a correct characterization. There's a lot that's being written in the Russian press that is blatantly wrong. As I say, the far right is a part of this and has exerted, and I guess you could say, an oversized role, but it's not dominating the movement. And the Russians say that this is a fascist movement. The other thing is they say that this will be a civil war. There is the risk. The Ukraine is a divided society, and obviously there is a large number of people who support this movement, but there's also a large portion who don't support the movement. And it is already, as I say, divided within itself. So the threat of civil war is definitely there, but we haven't reached that point yet.
The BBC's David Stern in Kiev. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Late today, President Yanukovych announced that he and members of the opposition had reached a truce and that negotiations are beginning to end the violence. That's been confirmed by one opposition leader. President Obama has been speaking about the situation, too. He had words of warning for both the government and its opponents.
We are going to be watching very carefully, and we expect the Ukrainian government to show restraint, to not resort to violence in dealing with peaceful protesters. We've said that we also expect peaceful protesters to remain peaceful.
That may sound as though the president isn't taking sides, but more and more outside governments are taking sides and putting their own spin on the latest developments. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
Who exactly is responsible for the violence in Ukraine? That depends on who's answering the question. When John Kerry spoke about the situation today, he did not explicitly blame the Ukrainian government for starting the latest round of deadly clashes, but the Secretary of State came close.
President Yanukovych has the opportunity to make a choice. A choice is between protecting the people that he serves, all of the people, and a choice for compromise and dialogue versus violence and mayhem.
Kerry said the U.S. believes the choice is clear and that there could be consequences for Ukrainian leaders.
We are talking about the possibility of sanctions or other steps with our friends in Europe and elsewhere in order to try to create the environment for compromise.
But it's not easy to see a path toward compromise between the U.S. and President Yanukovych's allies in Russia. When Moscow speaks about the violence in Ukraine, it's a completely different narrative. The Kremlin lays blame squarely at the feet of what it calls extremists and radicals among the Ukrainian opposition. John Kerry's Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, said today that what's going on in Ukraine is an attempted coup supported by Western nations. Lavrov's spokesman went even further. Alexander Lukashevich said Russia is outraged with Ukrainian opposition leaders and European politicians for failing to condemn the activities of radicals. In case anyone was missing the point, he also drew a parallel between the opposition and the Nazis of 1930s Germany. Foreign ministers with the European Union are scheduled to hold an emergency meeting about Ukraine tomorrow. Maya Koksiancic is a spokeswoman for the EU's High Commissioner for Foreign Policy. She told the BBC that the EU is considering all possible options for Ukraine. She said that includes sanctions against those responsible for what she called the repression and human rights violations that have played out. So does that mean the EU is taking aim at the government of Ukraine?
Well, I can't really go into the details of what the ministers will do tomorrow, but I think it's very clear that we are extremely worried with the events that we have seen. It's violence is completely unacceptable. We call on all responsible to immediately cease this violence.
Any new sanctions by the EU for Ukraine would require unanimous agreement by all 28 member states. James Schur is an expert on Ukraine at Chatham House, a think tank in London.
The kind of sanctions late in the day that we are probably talking about is unlikely to register sufficiently. But for all kinds of reasons, that's very difficult for EU democracies to do in unison and in a convincing way.
That was one of the underlying complaints that American officials had with the EU. We found out about that earlier this month when a leaked phone conversation between two State Department officials appeared online. The diplomats were caught bad-mouthing the EU and its approach toward Ukraine. They also discussed specific Ukrainian opposition figures and what role they might play in a new government. That opened the U.S. up to criticism that it's meddling in Ukrainian affairs, and it played perfectly into the Russian narrative of the Americans interfering in a country right on the Kremlin's doorstep. None of this bodes well for any sort of coordinated international solution for ending the crisis in Ukraine. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
For our next story, we're going to Afghanistan, but not the Afghanistan you see in the news. This one is a country of breathtaking valleys and mountains. The BBC's Bilal Sawari has been taking photos of this Afghanistan, and he's been posting them on his Twitter account as the Afghanistan you never see.
What I've been trying to do is to show to the world, if I could, that Afghanistan is a country which has beauty, which has beautiful people, and normal life goes on, as well as fighting, which has been now a very accepted fact of our lives for the last 30, 40 years. And Afghanistan is an extremely beautiful country with natural landscape, whether that's deserts or mountains. And I came up with the hashtag Afghanistan you never see because, unfortunately, of all the news about fighting and other problems, people almost forget that Afghanistan has this natural beauty.
How long have you been taking these photos?
Well, I've been taking these pictures since 2003, and over the years I've kept them. Only a few years ago when I graduated from college in the U.S., I thought it would be a great idea to go back to those pictures and start sharing them. But a lot of those pictures are recent as last year, earlier this year. And sometimes I would just go to my province in the east or another province, not on a BBC job, and I would just take these pictures. It's an extremely easy job to do. I've got an iPhone, I've got another camera, and these days in Afghanistan you have 3G, so sometimes I just share them as I travel.
You know, some of the pictures appear to have been taken from above. Did you take some of them from airplanes?
Well, one of the biggest frustrations that I've had as an Afghan, even that you really can't travel to a lot of the provinces in the same way that I was able to travel 7-6 years ago. The security situation has deteriorated. So most of those pictures are taken from helicopters during embeds with the U.S. military, with the Afghan government. At other times, I took them from an airplane.
I'm curious, you're Afghan and you're covering your own country for the BBC. Was there a sense of pride that somehow informed this? Like, you know, darn it, this is my country. And yes, I'm covering it for the outside world, but I want them to know what Afghanistan is really like.
Well, I think it's natural. It came from that. But Afghanistan can get very personal, even for people who are not from Afghanistan. And what gives me hope, what gives me these sort of ideas is the resilience, is the strength that you find in people. When you go to a remote village in Afghanistan and a villager who's stuck between the government, the Taliban, and the international forces, you know, he comes out, he's hospitable, he's not lost hope. It is natural that as a human being, you can simply not resist that.
I guess my final question is, was this a learning process for you, photographing Afghanistan in every possible nook and cranny? Did you learn things about your country you didn't know?
I think I did learn a great deal, and I've been extremely lucky to be able to travel to different parts of Afghanistan. It's a very multi-ethnic country with different ethnic groups, with different traditions and cultures. I've been thinking quite a lot every time I travel to these places that I want to be able to show something that has nothing to do with war and fighting, which unfortunately is true. But I think what most people have forgotten that there's normal life in Afghanistan, that Afghanistan has got the natural beauty, that the people living in those areas are normal people. That is the crux of this project, Afghanistan University, because it's about people, it's about their hope, and it's about their resilience.
Bilal Sawari is a reporter for the BBC. Thanks so much, Bilal.
Thank you.
Stroll through an Afghan market. We've got a slideshow of Bilal's Afghanistan You Never See photos at PRI.org. And this is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Last April's collapse of a clothing factory in Bangladesh is a story we've returned to several times, not just because of the death toll, it killed more than 1,100 workers, but also because the finger of blame was pointed at big international brands that source their products from Bangladeshi factories. Well, today marks a new chapter in this story and perhaps a new beginning for garment workers in Bangladesh. Stringent safety inspections have begun. They're the result of a legally binding deal between garment makers and many, but not all, major clothes labels in the West. The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Dhaka reports.
It was an 8-story building. The upper floors, which were the factory, had been built illegally on top of a shopping centre, and they all just crumbled. Garment workers had warned that cracks were appearing and getting larger because of massive generators installed illegally on the roof. The warnings were ignored. The workers were told they'd not be paid for the previous month if they didn't go in. Since then, dozens of famous name companies, including Abercrombie and Fitch, H&M, Marks and Spencer, have signed a legally enforceable Buildings and Fire Safety Accord, which provides the legal framework for the inspections which began here in Dhaka today.
This is now for real. We have 1,500 factories ahead of us in the next 8 months or so, and today is the start of that. From now on, it's full steam ahead.
That's Brad Lowen, Chief Safety Inspector for the Accord. There'll be planned inspections conducted on a scientific basis by professional engineers, not spot checks.
The factory owners typically are given 2 weeks' notice, and there's a number of things that we require for the factory to prepare for our arrival. Construction drawings of the building, plans, different schematics, that sort of thing, to make the inspection flow that much easier.
They'll check the weight of factory machinery and its suitability for the building, electrical wiring, fire escape routes.
One of the things might be that they have gates across their exit stairwells. And if they're locked open, then they like to think that now that's an acceptable scenario. Well, we don't allow the gates at all. They have to be removed.
And who pays for rebuilding or repairing major faults? The Accord's executive director, Rob Wace, dismissed reports that it will always be the big brands in the West.
The expectation is the factory owner will pay for the repairs. We know that in some cases they may not be able to pay all of it, and there will need to be a discussion between the brands and the owner for any gap to determine where those resources will come. But it's not that the brands are going to pay for all of these repairs or the factory owners aren't going to pay anything. And then there will be instruments in place to ensure, or best ensure, that the safe factory doesn't slide back into being an unsafe factory through monitoring programs and education and safety committee programs.
Hello.
TV on in one corner. This is the headquarters of the National Garment Workers Federation. Photos of Rana Plaza on the wall, of shrouded bodies, of survivors with amputated limbs, and a poster declaring Rana Plaza never again. The Federation President, Amirul Haq Amin, is very happy that the Accord inspections have started today.
This is actually the opportunity to make our garment industry as a safe workplace. Because you see, this is actually very much important industry for Bangladesh. This is the biggest industrial sector. 5,000 garment factories and the total workforce is 4 million.
So today could be a very significant day in the history of the garment industry in Bangladesh.
Yes.
But some are also concerned at the several very large Western companies like Walmart and Gap, which have chosen to sign an alternative voluntary agreement, not the legally binding accord. The Garment Workers Association say that there were already voluntary agreements in place when Rana Plaza collapsed, proving that voluntary agreements don't work.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield reporting from Dhaka. For the past few months, we've been doing weekly profiles of global chefs and tastemakers in New York City. We've got another tasty installment today. Ratha Chaupali is co-owner of Num Pang Restaurant in New York. His menu features Cambodian sandwiches and other delectables. Chaupali was born in Cambodia. He came to the States when he was 7. But his life in the food business didn't start with Cambodian food, and it didn't even start in New York. It started right here in New England.
My first real job when I was around 24 years old in the early 90s was buying sea urchin for processors in Massachusetts or buyers in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
sea urchin back in the 80s, the Japanese were running out of their stock in Japan, and they were searching out for new areas to catch. So sea urchin, or uni, in Maine were considered a pest. So a couple of Japanese guys came over and started buying it pennies to the pound, pennies to the pound. The world caught a hold of what was happening. Divers got smarter. You could make millions of dollars buying sea urchin, processing it, and selling it in Japan. What I had to do was judge the roe quality in the shell. Roe is the egg of the sea urchin. Quality was based on the size of the roe and the color of the roe. You know, you would grade it A plus would be the brightest orange. And the eggs itself are extremely tight together. And it wasn't just like learning that. It's learning how to deal with the diver. Because the diver, some of them, what they would do is that they would put all the bad ones in the middle of the tote and put some good ones on the top. And then if you're not an experienced buyer, you crack a few on a great quality and you say, you know what, I'm going to give you $3 a pound for it. You take it to the factory and they're like 80% of it is bad. There you go. It's a game you have to learn pretty very fast, or you basically lose your shirt. The sea urchin business was just like the restaurant business that I'm in now. There were moving parts, and you had to have some sort of a grasp on all of them at the same time.
That's Cambodian-born restaurateur Ratha Chaupali in New York. You can always get the latest from our newsroom. Just follow us on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. And as you may know, I edit our global cartoons section at The World Online. I keep my eye out for the sharpest commentary from cartoonists around the globe, and I've posted a number of cartoons about the Sochi Olympics and the violence in Ukraine. You can follow me on Twitter at Global Cartoons or find my posts on our Tumblr page. That's at pritheworld.tumblr.com. News headlines are next on PRI. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up on The World, an American visitor to the Sochi Olympics gives them a thumbs up.
The weather's great. The people are friendly. Good security. I like that. No problems. I haven't had any problems at all.
Plus, what's the drink of choice for Russian medalists? Hint, it's not vodka.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Just 5 days left of the Olympic competition in Sochi, while the excitement and the medal count continues, the crackdown on protesters next door in Ukraine may be overshadowing these final days. Simon Schuster has been reporting on the Games for Time magazine. We spoke to him from the Sochi press headquarters. He says the violence in Ukraine is a main topic of conversation among journalists, and it's on the minds of Ukraine's athletes as well.
The Ukrainian athletes made an official request to the International Olympic Committee to wear black armbands in solidarity and as a sign of mourning, really, for the 25 people who died in the last 24 hours in the violence in Kyiv. And the IOC refused to allow that. They took it as a political gesture, which is banned under the Olympic Charter. but the Ukrainian athletes insisted it was just a sign of mourning. So that disagreement certainly caused some controversy today, and the Ukrainian athletes were saying that people were coming up and expressing concern, expressing worry, expressing solidarity again with the protesters and really just with the Ukrainian people and the uncertainty that they face right now. So definitely it's something that's cast a shadow over the games.
What about among you and the press corps? Are people kind of preoccupied and looking for different sources of information, not just what's in front of them at Sochi?
One of the amazing things, and I think the unique thing about this revolution in Ukraine, is that there are multiple live feeds of the square where it's all unfolding. This revolution is not only televised, it's on a live feed, often with English translations. So while a very exciting hockey match, an Olympic hockey match, was going on in Sochi, a lot of the people in the press center were glued to their computers watching the live feed of the revolution in Kyiv. And a lot of people are taking off for Ukraine. Now I'm going later tonight at about 5 in the morning, Sochi time. So I'm going to be there the next day, and that means I'm going to have to miss the closing ceremony, which is a shame, but that's what the news calls for.
The Sochi Games, of course, were a huge coup for Russian President Vladimir Putin. I'm wondering how this whole drama going on in Ukraine, which is diverting attention, is that overshadowing his Olympic success?
In a lot of ways, it is. A lot of the debate right now in Ukraine and in Russia as well is around this mysterious conversation that Putin had with the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, last night, just as the violence was getting underway, just as the riot troops were storming the square in Kyiv. Putin and Yanukovych were on the phone. We don't know what they talked about, but Putin's spokesman confirmed today that that phone call took place. And it really led to a lot of speculation, certainly in Ukraine, but also in Russia, that the Kremlin has some hand in the decision to disperse the square violently. Now, again, we don't know what was said, but Russia has certainly put economic and diplomatic pressure on the Ukrainian government to resolve this crisis by force if necessary.
Now, in Sochi itself, there's been a few protests of late as these Olympics wind down. Just yesterday, a few members of Pussy Riot were detained. They were then released. Another environmental activist was arrested as well. Why are the protests suddenly bubbling up now with only a few days left of the Olympics?
That's a good question. I don't know the timing. I think that a lot of activists and a lot of human rights workers were expecting Russia to take a much softer line, at least during the Olympics, at least in Sochi and around Sochi. But that really hasn't happened. I mean, if the world was expecting a soft and friendly Putin during the games, they certainly have not gotten it. An environmental activist who was protesting Olympic constructions in Sochi and around Sochi was sentenced during the games last week to 3 years in prison. The most prominent political activist in Russia, Alexei Navalny, he has been forbidden from even visiting Sochi. And when the two young women from Pussy Riot visited yesterday, they were detained for several hours, leading to a pretty major international scandal. They were released, which I guess is a good sign. You know, they weren't sentenced again to 2 years in prison. But we're not seeing the softer line on human rights that I think many people were expecting during the Olympics.
Now, I want to switch gears here just a bit. You tweeted a photo this week of a Russian Olympic tradition. Can you describe that tradition?
Oh, it's a wonderful thing. So every Sunday at the Russian House, sort of a clubhouse for athletes and organizers here in Sochi, the Olympians who have won medals, they get together and a large tub of champagne is poured out, maybe about a gallon, and all of them are asked to dunk their medals into the champagne and then pass it around like a communal chalice and drink from it. And it was a really fun tradition to watch. The medals got all sticky, but the athletes didn't seem to mind so much. And, you know, it showed that the athletes really have a lot to celebrate. You know, this is their show, and they're doing really well. They're doing way better than they did at the last Winter Games in Vancouver, which were the worst Olympic showing ever for Russia, or the Soviet Union, for that matter. So there's a lot of celebration, certainly among the athletes. It's a shame that a lot of the political crises, the crackdowns on human rights, the revolution in Ukraine have overshadowed the celebrations of the athletes. You know, that's really what the games are about. And I think that tradition sort of summarized it for me. It was really great to see that.
But sadly, the Russian hockey team will not be among those dipping their medals in the champagne. Big loss for Russia today. What were the reactions there?
It was really unpleasant to see that. I have to admit, during Saturday's Russia-US game, I was in the stadium and I got to talk to a lot of the fans. And by the end of the game, I was rooting for Russia myself. I saw how much it would have meant to the fans and to the Russian people to have that win on their home turf. So it was sad to see that we will not get a rematch. There was still a possibility after Saturday's game of a rematch for the gold between U.S. and Russia, but that's not going to happen.
Simon Schuster, he's been reporting on the Sochi Olympic Games for Time magazine. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you.
Reporter Charles Maines is based in Moscow, but this week he's in Sochi, and he's struck by the friendlier Russia on display there. It's not exactly the Russia he recognizes.
Russia never seemed to settle on just one slogan for these games. Hot, cool, yours, that official theme. Let's just admit that doesn't really make sense. But emblazoned on an enormous building in Olympic Park, there's one that does.
Russia, great, new open.
Russia, great, new open. That's really the message Russia had hoped to deliver at these games, and one you hear a lot of people here say journalists went out of their way to ruin.
I was so excited about coming, and then I kept hearing things in the media about, you know, not to go, it's not safe. I don't think it helps if there's a lot of negative talk. It doesn't.
Nancy Blair traveled here from Vancouver, Washington, her fourth time at the Olympics. She says the Sochi Games stack up with any she's experienced.
But it's been a wonderful experience here. The weather's great. The people are friendly. Good security. I like that. The fact that they're checking people. I'm just on the seaport now, and it's just exciting. No problems? No problems. I haven't had any problems at all.
Which is what is just so weird about the Sochi Games. At the events, everything is kind of great. But is it real? Everywhere you look, exceptions have now become the rule. This is a Russia where cheerful people come up and say,
"Hello, can I help you?"
Wherever you go. Believe me, that doesn't usually happen. A Russia that recycles? No, sorry. And suddenly police are helpful, the service half-decent, smokers obey no smoking signs. None of this usually happens. But according to Alexei, who traveled from the Russian city of Volgograd to take in Olympic skiing, all that matters is that it's happening now.
The only people who don't like this are the ones who stayed home on their couches. Everyone who is seeing it with their own eyes sees it's wonderful. The volunteers are so cheerful. Everyone walking around is so positive. Everything's organized really well.
That Russia would put its best face forward is not surprising, of course, but local rights activists say a different story must be told. Thousands of migrant workers who built the Olympic arenas were deported shortly before the Games, many without pay. Environmental activists, too, have faced pressure, including the arrest of Yevgeny Vitushka, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison for protesting the Games. Now, athletes and spectators aren't to blame for enjoying themselves in spite of this, says local human rights activist Semyon Simonov. But Simonov says he hopes they would be aware and help improve the situation.
The Olympics are supposedly about promoting humanism and human rights. It's all in the Olympic Charter. When they prepared for the Olympics here, the government said Sochi would set an example for all of Russia. Well, now I see it's a bad example.
Another naysayer is Georgi Gagilov, a local businessman who runs a small Apple iPhone repair shop in downtown Sochi. He says no one, and I mean no one, he knows in Sochi is a fan of these Olympics because of the corruption, because of the rising cost of living, and, well, because his rent went up. We step outside to talk more, and Georgi points out the sign on his shop. At first glance, it's that iconic Apple logo we all know. Only Georgi says that to avoid any problems with the guys at Apple, he's altered it just a bit. And it's true. The bite from the apple is a bit deeper, the stem a little fatter. Now, would I have noticed if he hadn't pointed out the difference? Probably not. But as with Russia's Sochi Olympics, what you see depends on how hard you look. For the World, I'm Charles Maines in Sochi, Russia.
In Turkey, the issue of Islamic headscarves is a contentious one. For decades, the secular country banned women from wearing headscarves in schools and public places. When the Islamist Prime Minister Recep Erdogan came to power, he promised to end the restriction. And this fall, he and his socially conservative party finally made good on the promise. Dalia Mortada reports from Istanbul on how lifting the ban is playing out.
The restrictions had been around since modern Turkey was created in 1923. Founding father Kemal Atatürk hoped to shape an Islamic country with a strictly secular society. But Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development Party, or AKP, argued that the ban was discriminatory and at odds with the country's democratic ideal, which is pretty much what Huri Inegöl thought too.
Ben önce üniversitedeyken kapalı arkadaşlarım için protestolara katıldım. I actively protested for the right of women who wear headscarves to get into universities, because if I can go to school in my miniskirt, they should be able to come to school in their headscarves.
Inegöl is a secular-minded Turkish language teacher in central Istanbul. While she supported the idea that lifting the ban would mean more freedom for everyone, she says in practice, that's not how things are playing out.
Previously, when I wore miniskirts, I felt fine. There wasn't any social pressure or negativity. But today, a lot of people, whether it's with their facial expressions or their gestures, they make me uncomfortable and I can see it very clearly.
Inigo says lifting the headscarf ban has emboldened her more conservative neighbors to feel free to judge her for her clothing. And she says the AKP is doing nothing to discourage that attitude.
Ve onların rahat hissetmeleri, the conservative people feeling more freedom and more comfortable is in exchange for me feeling less comfortable and less free.
As a result, society's become more polarized. And Inigo says it's not just lifting the headscarf ban that's become troubling. She and others can point to lots of examples over the years of ways that the AKP has made a secular lifestyle more uncomfortable.
Ve biz buna da kesinlikle müdahil olduk.
Last fall, for example, the prime minister and other government officials attacked university students' living arrangements, railing against men and women living together as roommates. Erdogan said it was important that Turkey raise a pious and conservative youth. But Berna Aydın doesn't see it the same way. She's still smarting from the old laws and social stigma associated with the headscarf. They kept women like her out of the workforce.
Yani bir şirkette çalışacaktım, başvurmuştum.
I applied for a job in a company and everything was all right. And then they called me for an interview. When they saw me with a headscarf, they decided against hiring me. Actually, in 1999, we moved from Turkey to the US because I was really upset with the system with this headscarf issue.
But she and her husband moved back in 2006 when she saw attitudes in Turkey changing, becoming more open thanks to the AKP.
Our government has eliminated the headscarf issue, so many women started going to universities and working. More women entered the working life because of lifting the headscarf ban.
Aydın says she sees life as better for women these days. But one parliament member recently chastised the government for hypocrisy. Şafak Pave stood up in the chamber and lambasted the AKP for a rule that still stands. If the AKP really cared about everyone's personal freedoms, she said, they'd take a few minutes to change the ridiculous parliamentary rules that forbid me, as a woman, from wearing pants to work. For The World, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
Time for one more quick story before we go to the break. Rio de Janeiro is going to be a busy place during the next 3 years. There's a papal visit scheduled. This summer, the city plays host to the World Cup soccer tournament. And then in 2016, there's the Summer Olympic Games. It's a tall order for any city, so you can imagine how Rio's mayor, Eduardo Paes, is feeling these days. I mean, if it all goes well, he gets the credit. But if it goes wrong, well, he gets the blame. But in a recent interview with the BBC, Paes is nothing but positive.
I think it's a great thing for Rio. It's a great opportunity for change for the city.
But Paes does admit there's a lot of pressure.
It's not easy to explain and to let people understand, I mean, why you're spending money on a stadium and why you're doing this and that. I mean, and there's lots of works all over the city, so traffic, it's a big problem these days. Every day it's a big thing. So, I mean, it's lots of pressure. But things are going to go right. Brazil is a very special place. Rio is a very special city. We know how to deliver great events.
Rio has been the scene of unrest in the past year. People took to the streets to protest an increase in bus fares, among other things. But Paes says he welcomes the protests.
I think Brazil has to be proud because on the contrary of our past, you know, when we had a military rule, people could not go out on the streets. If they would go out, they would go to jail. I mean, people can protest now.
That's Rio de Janeiro's mayor, Eduardo Paes, speaking to the BBC. Just ahead, a musician, her iguana, and Game of Thrones. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The Philippines is the world's largest producer of coconuts, or at least it used to be. When Typhoon Haiyan struck in November, it took down some 33 million coconut palm trees. Reporter Aurora Almendral has the story of one coconut farmer near Tacloban who's trying to figure out what to do now.
In the Philippines, the coconut palm is called the tree of life. People here use every part of it to make brooms, soap, fishing nets, charcoal, paper, and lots of traditional foods. I've come to one coconut farm. There's a single pagan pen beside a maze of uprooted trees. The farmer's name?
Felipe Parado.
Felipe Parado Jr. He's a wiry man, 59 years old. He's been scampering up the skinny trunks of coconut trees since he was 5. He specializes in making tubat, the local coconut wine.
Yung tuba.
He describes how it's made. Climb the tree, he says, all the way to the top. Make a small slice at the base of the frond and let the sap drip into a plastic bottle. Keep it pure. Don't let any rainwater in, he says. This was Parado's job for nearly 50 years, until the day Typhoon Haiyan ripped through his village.
So now there's nothing. Everything's gone. We have nothing to sell, nothing to make into wine, no trees, finished. That's just how it is.
Parado laughs, not because it's funny, but at the absurdity of it all. In the municipality of Polo, where Parado lives, all of the coconut farms have been wiped out. Even the trees left standing are so severely damaged that they'll never bear fruit again. So Parado is doing the only thing there is left to do. He's having his downed trees cut into lumber. For each tree he sells to the sawmill, he'll get about $3. So far, the sawmill's trucks have come around to pick up 10 of his trees. He'll sell whatever he doesn't use to rebuild his house. But it's a paltry sum compared to what the trees earned him before. And after the trees are gone, he's not sure what he'll do for income. For now, Parado and his family are living off 2 sacks of rice given to them by a relief agency. He says they can stretch that out for a few months. After that, maybe he'll walk into town, ask around and see if anyone needs some carpentry or other work done. His long-term goal is to get back to coconut farming. I've already started planting. I've got a few trees going here and there, he says. But it'll take at least 6 years before Parado's new trees bear fruit. If I'm still alive then, he says, I'll be able to afford to live again. One day. For The World, I'm Aurora Almendral in Tacloban.
Okay, do you recognize this tune? If you're a fan, you know it's the theme from the wildly popular HBO series Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones began as a successful series of books by George R.R. Martin. Now it's in its 4th season on HBO. With all the popularity and high budget, it would seem natural for the theme to be recorded by a real live musician. But according to a well-known classical musician, it wasn't. Canadian violinist Lara St. John is a devout Game of Thrones fan, and she got fed up with what she says is a computer-generated opening theme. So she decided to take matters into her own hands. She hired a cellist and recorded her own live version. And she made a video to go with it, complete with a tiny dragon. Here's Lara's version. Caught up with Lara St. John on tour in Winter Park, Florida. Here's what she says was the giveaway that HBO's version wasn't human.
There's no sense of melody or flow. For a string player, it's what's between the notes. And this was just, every note was the same, there's no dynamic. It's not at all musical. The way I could probably describe it best is if you heard your favorite song as sung by your GPS machine. most people are more familiar with vocals and songs and voice, right? And for me, as a string player, I'm more familiar with the string sound. So it's kind of like auto-tune.
So you decided to take matters into your own hands, and you have created a live cello rendition. Have you received any response from HBO?
No, not from HBO, but from a hell of a lot of people.
Other Game of Thrones fans?
Some Game of Thrones fans. A lot of musicians, actually. A lot of musicians saying, yeah, we can't believe they did that. You know, especially cellists. I've heard from about 20, 30 cellists who said, oh my God, same thing. I have to fast forward over the opening theme. I mean, it's just so crazy. How could they do that? A Canadian engineer wrote me this morning and said, for example, I'm just doing a mini series now and their budget is only $4 million for 3 episodes. And they've managed to allocate $125,000 so that we can do an hour of original music with a symphony and a chorus.
Oh.
You know, but HBO obviously couldn't do that for their 4 minutes of their opening, because I don't think that the music is very important to them.
So you're convinced.
Because
not
only is it like a solo cello, which is sort of the most offensive, but the entire string orchestra is fake.
So you're convinced it's a money issue, not an aesthetic issue.
I think they just don't care. And that's what really makes me upset, because it gives credence to the fact that one might be able to replace live musicians with these computer-generated horrific supposed musical mind. If you're a big fan of the books, I mean, there's just so much guts and glory and rage and blood and passion, you know? I mean, the guy, he's got such an imagination. And they use this fake theme and this fake orchestra. It's just so wrong.
Now, the star of your own video is a dragon. Well, it's not exactly a dragon, but it's a very handsome creature. What is it?
He's my iguana. Actually, his name is Kane. He's about 4.5 years old, and he's 4 foot long and very cute.
Very cute. Laura, thank you so much. You can see Kane, you can see Laura, and you can listen to her live cello rendition for the Game of Thrones theme song. It's all at PRI.org. Thank you so much, Laura St. John.
Sure, thank you very much.
We contacted HBO to ask if the theme for Game of Thrones was computer-generated, but they didn't get back to us before we went to air. To take us out, here is Laura St. John performing Bach's Partita No. 2 in D minor. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org, the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.